Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the latest Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 22nd of May, these are our main stories. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, has offered MPs a vote on whether to hold a second referendum if they approve her Brexit withdrawal bill. The UN envoy to Libya says the country is facing a long and bloody civil war, which could threaten its neighbours and the wider Mediterranean region. The ex-president of Argentina, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, has gone on trial for corruption days after announcing she will run for office again. Also in this podcast...
I didn't have any trouble from the press or from the public. It was the editorial staff who were a bit dodgy. They were men in their middle years and they'd come from Fleet Street.
We look back at the life of the first woman to read the BBC television news. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, has told members of Parliament they have one last chance to deliver Brexit. In a speech in London, Mrs. May pledged that MPs would get to vote on whether there should be another referendum, but only if they first approved her EU withdrawal bill. The proposal is among concessions in a 10-point plan to persuade MPs to back the deal that Parliament has already turned down three times. This time, the Prime Minister took into account demands from the opposition Labour Party, including workers' rights and especially a possible second referendum.
I do not believe this is a route that we should take, because I think we should be implementing the result of the first referendum, not asking the British people to vote in a second one. But I recognise the genuine and sincere strength of feeling across the House on this important issue. The government will therefore include in the withdrawal agreement bill, at introduction, a requirement to vote on whether to hold a second referendum.
And Mrs. May made this appeal to her colleagues in Parliament.
I say with conviction to every MP of every party, I have compromised. Now I ask you to compromise too. We've been given a clear instruction by the people we are supposed to represent. So help me find a way to honour that instruction. Move our country and our politics forward and build the better future that all of us want to see.
Well, the opposition Labour leader, Jeremy Corbyn, said his party would not be backing the new proposals.
We can't support this bill because it's basically a rehash of what was discussed before, and it doesn't make any fundamental moves on market alignment or the customs union, or indeed protection of rights, but particularly in relation to consumer rights and the quality of the food that we will eat in the future. There's also, of course, the question of the deliverability of it. The Prime Minister has already indicated she's going to leave office. Many of her own MPs have already said they cannot support the bill. I can't see how it can get through Parliament anyway. No, we'll not be supporting it.
So, what compromises has the Prime Minister actually made? I asked our Westminster correspondent, Rob Watson.
I think there's very little in the way of compromise, really. I mean, I think what's most striking about her so-called bold new deal is that it's not that bold and that it's not that new, really. I mean, what's really striking is how her argument is essentially unchanged. And that argument is, if I paraphrase her, is, look, it's either my deal or the horrors, the economic risks of a no-deal Brexit, a general election, or no Brexit at all. Now, in order to sort of sweeten that pill and to try and get cross-party support, she's saying, look, you know, MPs will have a say in our future relationship with the European Union. And she's also saying, as we just heard, look, there could be a second referendum if you approve my deal and if you vote for one. I mean, of course, what MPs who want a second referendum are saying, hang on a minute, this is rubbish. You offer us, you guarantee the second referendum, then we'll back your deal.
And we've already seen across the political spectrum, it's been rejected.
Well, you know, that's that American acronym. I think it's DOA. I remember from when I lived in the US, dead on arrival. I mean, this really does have that feel. I mean, it looks like it's sort of too little, too late. And I think the real problem that she's facing is that, as she herself acknowledged in the speech, is that opinion in this country is now so polarised, with people either, yeah, let's get on and have a hard Brexit, or for goodness sake, let's stop this, that the idea of what she's trying, which is a sort of a compromise to appeal across that divide, it's just so hard to see how that comes off.
And that stark divide is going to be laid bare in the European parliamentary elections in the next couple of days, isn't it?
Absolutely, and that's why I think her pitch is going to be even more difficult. If you think about it, she's going to bring it back to Parliament in the first week of June after, and that will follow elections where what we expect to happen, what the polls suggest, is that parties which are absolutely adamantly against Brexit will pick up votes, but so will the Brexit Party, which, as you can guess from the title, is very enthusiastic about it. Not exactly a mood for compromise created from that result.
Rob Watson in Westminster. The United Nations envoy to Libya, Ghassan Salameh, has warned that fighting on the edge of the capital, Tripoli, marks the start of a long and bloody war. Our Middle East analyst, Alan Johnston, has more details.
Addressing the UN Security Council, Mr. Salameh painted a dire picture. He said unless the flow of arms to Libya was halted, there could be a descent into an all-against-all state of chaos. He said the civil war could split the country and threaten its neighbours and the wider Mediterranean region. The battle for Tripoli began last month when the warlord, Khalifa Haftar, who's backed by Egypt and the UAE, launched an offensive. He's been confronted by militias loosely aligned to the UN-backed government.
Alan Johnston. In recent weeks, there's been an American show of force in the Middle East. Washington deployed warships and military jets to the Gulf, saying there were unspecified threats from Iran. Now the acting US Defense Secretary, Patrick Shanahan, has briefed Congress about the increased tension in the region, saying that the alleged threat from Iran has receded as the result of America's actions.
Our biggest focus at this point is to prevent Iranian miscalculation. We do not want the situation to escalate. This is about deterrence, not about war. We're not about going to war. This is about continuing to protect our interests in the Middle East and conducting the missions that we are there to perform.
I spoke to the BBC's Barbara Plett-Usher in Washington, and I asked her about Mr. Shanahan's comments.
He has been asked by Congress, as have the other senior officials in the administration, to explain what is going on, because there was this very aggressive war rhetoric last week and increasing the military presence in the region with an aircraft carrier and B-52 bombers and so on. So there was a lot of concern expressed. What he's saying now is that, look, we were trying to deter Iranian attacks. This was not about us going to war. And we have been successful because although the threat still remains, the attacks are not imminent anymore. The Iranians got the message. And we have prevented attacks on American interests. And so what we want to do now is try to keep the Iranians from making any miscalculations. So yes, he is toning down the administration's rhetoric. He's saying the approach worked. And he's trying to tell lawmakers and get lawmakers convinced that the threat is real and the administration took the appropriate action.
I suppose the concern is that there have been mixed messages coming out from the administration, and that if there is another inflammatory tweet, for example, from President Trump, that might sow more confusion in the future.
Yes, I mean, President Trump has had not just inflammatory tweets, of course. He's alternated over the past 10 days between threats and between invitations to dialogue. And you could argue that that's his style. He likes to keep the other side guessing. He likes to keep them on their toes. He thinks that gives him an advantage. Then the other side and frankly, Congress people, too, are left wondering, well, is this just bluster or what is it? Now, we've seen him do this with other parties. But I think the concern is Iran is not just any other party in the Middle East, is not just any other region. You do not want to set the stage for a misunderstanding that could lead to confrontation.
Barbara Plett-Usher in Washington. Abortion rights activists have taken part in coordinated rallies across the United States to protest against several states passing tough laws to restrict terminations. Ali McBull is in Washington.
Last week, Alabama passed the strictest law so far, making abortion illegal at any stage of pregnancy. But in total, 16 states, mainly in the South, have either passed or are debating new anti-abortion measures. A large protest took place outside the U.S. Supreme Court here in Washington. It's the calculation of those tabling these anti-abortion bills across the country that they'd be challenged and taken up by the Supreme Court, where they feel, thanks to the conservative justices appointed by Donald Trump, they could eventually get a ruling that removes the right to have an abortion for millions of American women.
Ali McBull. Argentina's former president, Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner, has appeared in court at the opening of a major corruption trial. Ms. Fernandez is accused of taking bribes from construction firms in exchange for inflated government contracts. From the courtroom, Ms. Fernandez tweeted that the case against her was a smokescreen and an act of persecution. For more on those accusations, James Kumarasamy spoke to Maria Esperanza Casullo, who is an associate professor of political science at the National University of Río Negro in the south of Argentina.
She is basically accused of having directed, I guess would be the word, some sort of conspiracy to rig the bids for public works, specifically in the province of Argentina, where her husband used to be governor of.
And she's also accused of profiting from it, taking kickbacks.
Yeah, taking kickbacks.
And it comes just a couple of days after she announced that she will be running in October's presidential election, although not as a presidential candidate, but as a vice presidential candidate. That seemed to come as something of a surprise.
Oh, I think it came as totally a surprise. This is really a first in Argentine political history. The fact that a person that, according to every poll, has a decent shot to become the next president and voluntarily step down from that. But the vice presidency in Argentina has almost no power whatsoever.
Is she still popular?
She's very popular with a segment of the population, which according to the polls is roughly 30%. And she's also very unpopular with another segment of the population that also hovers around 30%. So she is very loved by a segment of the public and very hated, I would say, by another segment of the public.
What kind of role is this trial likely to play politically, do you think? As I understand it, she has immunity as a sitting senator, so even if she is found guilty, she won't go to prison.
She won't get to prison for as long as she's still in the Senate. Everybody seems quite certain that there's not going to be a verdict before the elections.
And in terms of the bigger political picture, the economy's not doing well at the moment. It would appear in many ways that the political conditions where the IMF is seen to have put unnecessary constraints on Argentina are pretty similar to the conditions when first her husband and she came to power.
Yes, very much so. It was very clear when at the very last years of her presidency that the Argentine economy, you know, had some problems and was not doing well. This government, the government of President Macri, won elections with this sort of discourse saying we have these problems, but they are very manageable. And they just have to do with how bad the Kirchnerist government is. And now, almost 4 years after that, the economy has actually not improved. It has become worse for most of the people in Argentina. And the government doesn't have a lot to say about this.
That was Maria Esperanza Casullo from the National University of Río Negro in Argentina. It's now widely known that the amount of plastic being used by consumers is choking the oceans and harming the environment. One company in the US is launching a new program that sells products in reusable containers. Consumers can buy a range of goods from laundry liquid to ice cream in containers that can be sent back to be cleaned and refilled. The program has support from big companies like Unilever and Procter & Gamble. Samira Hussein got an inside look on how this recycling company called Loop operates.
At New York City's main recycling plant, an excavator hoists waste into an enormous pile. It hoists anywhere from 75 to 90 metric tons every day. Our obsession with single-use plastic has created a mountain of a problem that is destroying the environment.
I want to say it's a better container than the disposable kind.
Melissa Spurr is trying to be part of the solution. Everyday items in her kitchen and cupboards are now in reusable containers. They are supplied and filled by a new program called Loop.
How has your daily household operation changed?
Well, my cabinets look a lot neater with the packaging. That's a bonus. But also, it just changes the way you start to think about the waste you're creating and the stuff that you are putting in your trash. Because now you're saving all these bulky packages, often like things that are not recyclable even, you know. So you notice your trash is getting reduced. And you just start to become more mindful of what's in your cabinet. Why aren't we reusing more things? Why is it that our economy has developed in such a way that everything's so disposable and not available to even buy if you want it to in reusable packaging?
Luke may have changed Melissa's cabinets, but it hasn't changed her cleaning habits. She's using a famous brand name cleaning spray on her counters that she ordered online from Loop. It was shipped to her in a metal container that was ready to use. Once she's finished, she will send it back to Loop, where it will be cleaned and filled again for someone else to use.
This is where all the magic happens. We're actually walking through an office made completely from garbage, top to bottom.
That's Tom Zaski. He's the CEO of the recycling company TerraCycle. TerraCycle is the creator of Loop, which delivers Melissa's cleaning products. Mr. Zaski believes his reusable scheme will work because multinational corporations like Procter & Gamble, Nestle, and Unilever have signed on.
It's not that plastic is bad. It's metal is bad. Paper is bad. Plastic is bad if you use it once. And so we need to let these amazing materials go around and around and around. And so Loop was born as a waste solution. How do we move an average consumer from disposable consumption to durable multi-use consumption?
But breaking the addiction to plastic will require a massive change from consumer goods companies like Unilever, who have built a business on providing consumers with products in disposable packaging at an affordable price.
Loop, when we sort it out and get it right, will be a win-win.
Jostein Solheim is the executive vice president of foods and refreshments at Unilever. He says having other companies like Procter & Gamble, like Nestle, participate in Loop gives the initiative a chance at success.
As manufacturers, as we can together at scale change the behavior and make it easy to do this, we will go back to competing on brands and propositions like we did before. So I think it's a win for the consumer, a win for the planet, and win for the industry.
I'm curious, though, what drives a business to do this? Because it costs you more, and it's a harder sell to consumers.
From a purely financial point of view, you have to future-proof your business. And we firmly believe that people will demand this type of change from companies, from retailers, from the industry around them.
It is perhaps that faith in reusable containers that may finally move the mountain of waste.
That report by Samira Hussain in the United States. Our new podcast, 13 Minutes to the Moon, is into its second episode. This week, with the rather astonishing fact that when Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed on the moon, the average age of the operators in Mission Control was just 27. These were young people hired by NASA straight from college to become part of the Mission Control hive mind. Hundreds of young engineers diagnosing and solving problems across the void of space. 50 years later, Kevin Fong's been talking to some of them. That's 13 Minutes to the Moon from the BBC World Service, the story of exactly how humans landed on the moon. Search for 13 Minutes to the Moon wherever you found this podcast. Who has access to energy and how much of it is more than just an economic question. It's a matter of national security. The United States Energy Secretary Rick Perry has warned that companies involved in a gas pipeline being built to link Germany and Russia are likely to face sanctions. The pipeline, known as Nord Stream 2, is scheduled for completion this year. Our economics correspondent Andrew Walker told me more about the project and its significance.
Europe already has extensive pipeline connections with Russia, and in particular Germany has one, an undersea pipeline known simply as Nord Stream. But this project, Nord Stream 2, is also linking Russia with Germany underwater, but increasing the capacity quite substantially. So it would mean that Germany could import even more gas directly from Russia than it already does.
Now, I mentioned, obviously, many countries have interests in who has energy. It's a national security issue. But what, on what basis would the United States actually bring sanctions, and on who exactly?
Their concern, I think, is twofold. One is just a general wariness about the very idea of Europe and Germany in particular being even more dependent on Russia for their supplies of energy, and in particular gas. But there's also an issue here about Ukraine. Currently, a substantial part of that gas coming from Russia transits through Ukraine, and there are periodic crises over access fees, over the price that Ukraine pays for the gas that it actually uses. And that has caused some disruption to the supply to Europe at times. And so one of the things I think the Americans and others are concerned about is that this kind of new pipeline might enable Russia to completely bypass Ukraine and do some significant damage to its economic interests in the process.
And if indeed sanctions are put in place, presumably countermeasures may well be forthcoming as well.
What, from the European Union?
Yeah.
They would certainly want to think about that, but it's something they have tended rather more to go about this kind of thing by trying to find ways to directly counteract the effects of the sanctions, to try and make it more difficult for European companies to actually comply with the American law, which can put the European companies in an extraordinarily difficult position.
Andrew Walker. The pharmaceutical giant Johnson & Johnson says it's been ordered to pay at least $25 million to a woman who alleges that she got cancer through the use of the company's talc-based products. The company faces more than 14,000 similar claims. From New York, Neda Tofik reports.
Donna Olson suffers from mesothelioma, a rare form of cancer that is caused by exposure to asbestos. She said that she got it from Johnson & Johnson's baby powder and its shower product, which she used daily for decades. The jury has awarded her $25 million in compensation and will meet next week to decide on possible punitive damages. Johnson & Johnson plans to appeal the decision. The company maintains that its products are safe, and it says a key expert witness gave false testimony, which led to significant legal and evidentiary errors.
That was Neda Tofik in New York. And there's a similar damage-based story coming out of France, where a woman whose husband was killed when a Boeing airliner crashed in Ethiopia in March is suing the company for almost $280 million. The lawsuit filed in the United States alleges that Boeing failed to inform pilots about the risks posed by software used on the 737 MAX aircraft. The lawyer defending the family, Noman Hussein, gave more details.
We have asked a jury in the United States of America, after considering all of the evidence, after considering Boeing's reckless and willful actions in which it consciously disregarded the safety of its passengers, to award a minimum in the form of a punishment to Boeing, $276 million.
All 157 people on board the Ethiopian Airlines flight were killed. Boeing says it's updating the 737 MAX's software. Last week, San Francisco, one of the most tech-savvy cities in America, banned the use of facial recognition technology by police. In China, such systems allow the authorities to locate citizens in seconds, and if officials identify what they regard as poor behaviour, it can limit job prospects or even the right to travel. But concerns about facial recognition in law enforcement have been growing around the world. Here in the UK, the first major legal challenge to the unregulated use of the technology has begun. Peter Goffin has more.
Ed Bridges was in Cardiff's busy downtown in December 2017 when he saw a white van. It was being used by law enforcement, he realized, to take facial recognition scans of people who were out doing their Christmas shopping. Mr. Bridges, who is going to court to challenge the use of facial recognition in the UK, called it a fundamental violation of privacy.
My concern with the way this technology is being used is that it is essentially unregulated. And the reason for bringing the legal challenge is to try to make sure that at the very least there is proper and tougher regulation around how this technology is used so that the public can have confidence in the technology and in the police.
Police around the world have used some form of facial recognition technology for the past 20 years, ostensibly to track down criminal and terrorism suspects. They scan crowds of people, creating what's called a biometric map that codes each person's facial features into data. Police then compare that data to images on their watch lists. But human rights advocates have argued this technology is akin to taking a person's DNA or fingerprints without their consent. What's more, they say, it makes everyone a suspect. Here's Silky Carlo, the director of the UK privacy group Big Brother Watch.
We're not talking about identifying one individual. We're talking about everyone on a street having their identity checked. It's the modern equivalent of show me your papers. And that's very undemocratic. And we've seen ordinary members of the public being affected by it as well. We've seen people being misidentified. I've even witnessed a child being misidentified on his way home from school and swooped by plainclothes police officers and asked to prove that he's not a wanted criminal.
That prospect of people being misidentified is causing deep concern, even within the tech community. Last month, Microsoft revealed that it refused a request by police in the U.S. to install facial recognition in officers' cars and body cameras. Microsoft has called the use of facial recognition in law enforcement a threat to human rights and pointed out that this technology has been built using white male faces as a template. So the risk of misidentification is disproportionately high for women and non-white people. Last week, the city of San Francisco became the first in the U.S. to ban facial recognition technology. Officials there said one of their major concerns was that the software could be misused to target protesters, activists, or marginalized groups. Already, there are international calls for similar bans in other cities. It's an issue that governments everywhere are going to have to address.
Peter Goffin. An advertisement in Hong Kong featuring a same-sex couple will be allowed to appear on the transport network, despite initially being banned. As our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow reports, the ban provoked strong opposition.
The advert shows two men holding hands as they walk barefoot on a sandy beach. They appear to be gazing lovingly at each other. Written alongside is the slogan, "Move Beyond Labels." It's part of a promotional campaign for the territory's airline, Cathay Pacific. Wei Chan, Hong Kong's first openly gay lawmaker, declared the advert bold and timely. But soon after its release, local media reported that the poster had been banned from being displayed at the airport and on the subway system. There was an immediate outcry. Gay and lesbian groups urged people to take photographs of themselves holding hands at transport hubs. That seems to have forced a change of heart. The airport authorities now say the advert does not infringe guidelines. The subway operator has said something similar. Hong Kong does not recognise gay marriage, but this is a much discussed issue, particularly after developments on the nearby island of Taiwan, which last week became the first place in Asia to recognise same-sex marriages.
Michael Brister. New research into the bonobo, a Central African ape that's similar to a chimpanzee, suggests that the role of the mother extends to finding sexual partners for sons and even standing guard while they have sex. Richard Hamilton reports.
The researchers studied several wild bonobo populations in the Democratic Republic of Congo. It's been known for some time that females play a leading role in bonobo society, but what's new about this research is how actively involved they are in encouraging their sons to mate. Dr. Zanna Clay, who's a primatologist at the University of Durham here in the UK, explains how they chaperone males towards fertile females.
The bonobo mothers have central positions in their groups, which means that the sons can actually come close to other fertile females as a sort of byproduct of being near their mother. So they kind of profit as a social passport. And then mothers also do behavioural sort of strategies. So they might break up someone else's mating. So another male having sex, she'll run in and break it up. And she may also stop other males from breaking up her son's matings. So she's sort of really acting as a bit of a defender of her son's mating access.
The hard work that the mothers put in seems to pay off. They get to spread their genes without having to have more children themselves. The researchers also found that males who live with their mothers are 3 times more likely to have offspring than those whose mothers are absent. And finally, unlike humans, having a mother watching closely while the young couple copulate doesn't seem to put them off.
Richard Hamilton reporting. Nan Winton, the first woman to read the BBC television news, has died at the age of 93. She first appeared in that role in June 1960, but she was taken off air later that year after audiences complained that it was not acceptable to have a woman reading the late news. Jane Frances Kelly looks back at her career.
Well, next Friday at 3 o'clock, we start a new series called Information Desk.
Nan Winton, working as a TV presenter and journalist in 1955. The BBC doesn't have a recording of her first appearance reading the TV evening news in June 1960. But in later years, interviewed on the documentary series Arena, she talked about the experience.
I didn't have any trouble from the press or from the public. It was the editorial staff who were a bit dodgy. They were men in their middle years and they'd come from Fleet Street.
Nan Winton read the late TV bulletin 7 times before being removed. According to audience research, viewers thought her presence was unacceptable, even though Barbara Mandel had read the midday TV news on ITN in 1955. The late BBC executive, Stuart Hood, said there had been huge resistance when he suggested women should appear on the corporation's TV news bulletins.
Now, this was greeted by my editors with alarm, dismay and resistance. The thought that a woman could be conveyor of truth and of authority on the television screen was something you couldn't imagine, couldn't accept.
There was no regular female TV newsreader on the BBC until Angela Rippon joined the 9 o'clock news in 1975.
That report by Jane Frances Kelly. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.